time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for May 11th, 2019. The first item of business is that the broadcast and streaming version that airs on Saturday evenings at 88.7 FM WJCU here in Northeast Ohio will move to Saturday mornings from 7:30 to 8:30 a.m. next Saturday, May 18th. This also means that the podcast will be available earlier on Saturdays as well. Your app should automatically find and download it for you, or if you haven't subscribed to the podcast, why not? You can go to www.outspokencyclist.com and do that. Or you can check your podcast app to make sure that the May 18th show comes in. I don't believe you're going to have to change anything on your end, though. Once again, the Outspoken Cyclist will begin airing Saturday mornings at 7:30, beginning next Saturday, May 18th. So the Amgen Tour of California will begin tomorrow, May 12th, and run through next Saturday. Teams from the U.S., the World Tour, and the Continental teams will be competing in both men's and women's races. The men's stages begin in Sacramento and end in Pasadena. The women, who will not be racing seven stages, but rather only three, which in and of itself is fairly controversial, will start on May 16th in Ventura and also end in Pasadena. If you're interested in seeing the team rosters, the sign-ins, surfboards, that's what they're using for leaderboards, and the routes, you can log on to AmgenTourOfCalifornia.com. Much of the event will be covered by NBC Sports also. So let's get to this week's show. With the beginning of the Amgen Tour, which is arguably the U.S.'s most popular spring stage race, as backdrop, my first guests are Joe Harris and Steve Maxwell of the Outer Line blog. According to their blog, the Outer Line is the path often taken by cyclists who are unable to break into the lead-out train, but whose strength, resolve, and tactical cunning can lead them to victory. The Outer Line provides an independent perspective on the challenges facing the sport and offer an objective forum for analyzing its key structural, economic, governance, and ethical aspects. So what Joe and Steve say is, it's time to listen to new ideas and change direction. It's time to take the Outer Line. So with those words as background, I wanted to explore a new project they're working on. Neither Joe nor Steve comes from a cycling background, and both hold full-time jobs outside of the bike industry. But both of them have an abiding interest in the sport, especially when it comes to the economics of racing and what it might take to bring cycling into the national spotlight. So it seems Rafa had some of the same questions, and they tasked Joe and Steve to look into the issues that might be preventing cycling from growing and thriving, and to come up with a plan, or at least some ideas for a plan. What Joe and Steve have discovered and learned is being published in the RAFA Roadmap Report, a 10-part series that looks at what is lacking in cycling and what other pro sports have done that might work for our sport. We'll break it down here in a few moments. Then after a break, we'll welcome back Denise Korenik. When we spoke with Denise back in January of 2017, she and her driver Shay Holbrook had just set the women's paced land speed record at over 143 miles per hour. Then, with the urging of her coach, retired pro cyclist John Howard, Denise realized that resting on those laurels wasn't enough. And last September, she and Shay set out to break the world record, a record that stood for over 60 years. But they didn't just break it, they smashed it. When we talk with her, we'll learn what it took to do that and whether there are other goals out there for her. So let's get to our conversation with Joe Harris and Steve Maxwell from the Outer Line. Hello, gentlemen. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Diane. This is Steve Maxwell, and my colleague Joe Harris is on with us, too.
Excellent.
Pleasure to be here.
So we are going to talk about the RAFA Roadmap report, along with your other work, The Outer Line. But let's talk about the report first. I'm wondering, first of all, who you guys are and how you got involved with RAFA, and then who commissioned the report and what it is. So start with who you are.
Yeah, okay. I can start off. This is Steve. Joe and I connected with each other 5 or 6 years ago through some mutual contacts in the pro cycling industry, and found that we were both sort of interested in researching and analyzing and writing more on the broader issues of governance and economics and sort of the economic structure of pro cycling. And we found that we had some common interests and some compatibilities. And so we established a website and sort of a regular blog that we call The Outer Line, where we write regularly on these sorts of topics. We also write on a variety of more competitive and race-oriented topics, and have conducted interviews with a lot of leading kind of racers or team managers or owners or governance officials around the sport. But I guess we've tried to carve out a little bit of a niche in the area of more sort of what's behind the sport, what makes it function, what are the challenges and problems that it faces, and in a little bit more of a, I guess I would say a little bit more of a long form sort of format. We typically write articles that are, you know, 4, 5, 6 pages or longer in length. So we're perhaps a little bit different than most of the primary websites out there. And we delve into some of these economics and governance issues in a little bit more detail. We both have, I'll speak for myself first and then turn it over to Joe. We both have kind of other kind of real jobs. This is kind of a sidelight passion for us, although it ends up taking up quite a bit of time and we spend quite a lot of effort on it. I personally am involved in the water resource and environmental industries in Colorado and in the western United States. I work a lot in corporate transactions in the water treatment, water resources, water rights arena, and have been active in that area for 25 or 30 years, but have always had sort of a real passion and interest in the sport of cycling. I'm a pretty active cyclist myself and have always been interested in understanding what makes this sport tick. And so Joe and I both kind of have other careers and lives. We do spend a lot of time on the cycling business, and I'm interested to talk to you about it today.
This is Joe. So my background in cycling goes back a bit longer than Steve's. I raced as a junior, including a stint in Europe, as an exchange, a sporting exchange program, and have maintained cycling as a backbone or a foundation of my life ever since. So that's basically the last 35 or so years of my life. And whereas Steve has been more on, you know, building that business acumen and discovering cycling later, I came back to cycling almost by accident. So I'm a consultant in business and information technology. In the mid-2000s, I happened to get pulled over into CSC, Computer Science Corporation. What was CSC? It's merged and become another company now. But the professional cycling team, the Pro Tour team, was in our consulting budget. It was our program. And so I came back into cycling a little bit sideways there. But when that program wrapped up and through our mutual contacts in professional cycling on the business side, we again matched up, as you said, in our passion for the sport and our business acumen in excess of 60 plus years of overall experience in a variety of different circumstances and contexts. We've been able to leverage that, a sequence of knowledge and an acumen of practice to a sport that has never really applied business logic and business sense to its operations and its financial models. And so here we are today.
Welcome to the bike industry. I think it's not just the racing part of it. Let me remind our listeners quickly, we're speaking with Steve Maxwell and Joe Harris. We're talking about the RAFA Roadmap report and their website, The Outer Line, which is a pretty comprehensive website, as Joe was saying. So given, and I've read a lot of your website, and I did read chapter one of the RAFA roadmap report. Tell us what the RAFA, that's what brought me to you was this report. It came out through Velo News, I think. What is the RAFA roadmap report? And I really like some of the things that have already come out of it.
Yeah, I'll speak to that first, Diane. So a couple of years ago, we were approached by the executive management at RAFA with this idea of developing some sort of a broader review or summary, or at the time, I think we were calling it a manifesto, about the underpinnings of the sport of cycling and what a company like RAFA could try to do to help address and correct or improve some of these circumstances or challenges that the sport faces. And of course, Joe and I had already been thinking about and working and writing on some of these topics. And so they asked us to join together with a third person, Professor Dom van Reet at the University in Belgium, who's also he's a professor of economics with a real focus and expertise in pro cycling. So a guy that had some similar kind of background and interest and experience to ours to help them put together this report. And it's been a kind of a long and winding road over the last couple of years. But the main intent, I think it's fair to say the main intent was RAFA had really two purposes in mind. One, they wanted to do their kind of civic duty or do something to sort of give back to the sport that they built their business on by commissioning a study like this to try to help solve some of the challenges that we all face. But secondly, you know, from a more personal perspective, I think they also, you know, they also want to see this sport grow and find more people that they can sell their products to and get involved in cycling. So they kind of came at it from both those perspectives, and they asked us to help them write this and research this report.
Well, the report does give us some problems and you sort of lay them out, and then you actually lay out some ideas on eight lessons from other professional sports. Let's talk a little bit about the problems you came up with first. There are 12 listed in this report. Mm-hmm. And I think most people could probably pinpoint a few of them, but pick a couple of them that maybe we wouldn't think about and tell us how you came up with them.
Do you want to address that one, Joe? Or I mean, I guess maybe let me talk to the two or three of the sort of primary issues, and then maybe Joe can highlight a couple of the sort of secondary issues. I mean,
the main
issues that we've always had in the sport is the lack of a revenue base. That the sport is played out on the road rather than in a stadium, and so while the advantage of that is that it allows fans to be closer to the action and to interact with the athletes and all that sort of thing that makes the sport very attractive, it kind of robs the sport of any ability to generate revenue or to charge a fee for tickets to the event and so forth that, you know, upon which most other sports are built. And so there's always been this reliance on sort of a ever-changing and always fickle sort of sponsorship that seems to, you know, come in and out and change all the time and create this sort of general aura of instability or uncertainty in the sport. I think the main underlying challenge or issue has always been this sort of financial uncertainty or undependability of the sport, and a lot of the other things that sort of that sort of are related or come out of that. In addition, we've had all the, you know, the image challenges of the last, you know, two or three decades, where cycling seemed to be sort of the poster boy for cheating and for doping and for all kinds of illicit activities. So there's this image problem that the sport is also fighting in terms of trying to build a bigger audience. Joe, why don't you touch on some of the other central sort of challenges?
Yeah, and maybe this gets to the heart of the economics. It gives you an idea of some of the complexity that you dig into once you peek under the hood, as we did. And one of the big things is the lack of availability of the content. And with cycling, it's not that there aren't races you can watch. It's that you actually can't watch them. This gets to the heart of the structural problem of the sport, and that the race organizers, and using as an example, perhaps the Tour of Flanders, Flanders Classics organization, the number of contracts that it cuts for broadcasting the content of the race, there's a multitude of them, and it's cut across country lines and regionality, but also both online and on terrestrial broadcast and cable broadcast. And when you look at the number of contracts that were cut and the way that the content is then parsed out and its availability across regions, you quickly realize that they've not just stepped down the product, but they've diluted the value of the property. And when you then spread that out over an entire season of all these different races, cutting multiple contracts with different organizations and not being able to centralize that quote-unquote World Tour calendar into one package, that lack of cohesion and inability to monetize the content in a cohesive way is really killing the sport. When you compare it to other leagues and organized sports, which have been able to do that and really maximize that value and build suspense and have a really strong narrative. Cycling simply doesn't have that. It has its history, but it's not been able to leverage that in the context of a modern economy.
Let me ask you a real quick question before you move to the next point, and that is, do you think that having that cohesive kind of package to present would then translate into more broadcast rights? Right now, to find racing, there are some online portals where you can sign up, pay money, whatever. But the sport, at least in the United States, doesn't have the kind of cachet it does in Europe. So if they committed more of a package to a broadcast entity like CBS or NBC or even ABC, do you think that cycling in turn would be able to grow and get more sponsorship? I mean, it seems to me it's all tied together somehow.
It is. I'll start. This is Joe, and Steve can fill in some of the gaps. What you get when you create a cohesive broadcast package is the ability to value it to an economy of scale. In other words, right now, you have to sign up multiple websites to get a full calendar of racing. And, you know, according to many sources and even just a cursory scan of the legal and available feeds in the United States for a professional cycling full calendar could be as high as $600 or more based on the number of subscriptions that you sign on for and keeping continuity with the subscriptions with the packages to be able to just watch the cycling. If you made that cost effective and you were able to value that at, say, you know, $50 for the season or $100 for the season, and you get every race with a consistent look and feel with a consistent broadcast quality, that's something fans, I think, can get behind. If they're spending $600 or if they're pirating the feed and devaluing the sport even more, pirating it from multiple sources through multiple means, all that helps to, it's downward pressure on cycling's economy. They're trying to present value for the sponsors, and yet the delivery modality is completely diluting and stepping down the sponsor message with zero activation.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Let me remind our listeners once again, we are speaking with Steve Maxwell and Joe Harris of the RAFA Roadmap Report and the Outer Line. We're going to take a real quick break, and we're going to be back to talk some more and about some of the possible remedies seen from other sports. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Hi, we're back. If you're just joining me, you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're speaking with Steve Maxwell and Joe Harris. They are the authors of The Outer Line and the RAFA Roadmap Report. We've been talking about some of the issues that cycling has economically to keep it viable in front of fans like you, those who watch cycling and who want to watch cycling and maybe perhaps haven't been able to figure out how and how it can grow. So when we left off, we were talking about a sort of a cohesive broadcast package idea. What are some of the other things that need to be looked at in the sport? And then I'd like to go to your part of this report that talks about the lessons you found in other professional sports, which I find very interesting. But let's wrap up a few of the other items that maybe would clearly show our sport is not working.
Steve, I'll add another one. This is Joe Harris. One of the other areas that we found that really is anachronistic in global team sports is that cycling does not have a cohesive and unified body representing the athletes. One of the things we've spotted across multiple sports and through our work with athlete union leaders in the space, including Brendan Schwab of the Uni World Players Association and his predecessor, Walter Palmer, is that unless the athletes have a seat at the table in the decision-making process and the negotiating process for change, nothing really big happens in those sports. It revolutionized baseball. It has driven basketball. It has created a strong NFL Players Association, which has taken on the issues that are critical, such as the chronic brain injury disorders affecting players. Cycling has nothing like that. It has the framework for potential union body, but it's never come together with all of the national associations of athletes. And that's something that really does need to change for the sport to continue its evolution. And that's just another example of one of these things we found that, you know, both within the sport intrinsically is strange to see, but when compared to other sports is a deficit.
How about women? How are the women faring or not faring in the sport? And how will more attention being paid to women cycling maybe enhance that package that a broadcast system might look at?
Steve, if you don't mind, I'll start this one, and you can chime in. This is Joe again. And women's cycling has been a central point of our work since we started. And I will thank you again, Diane, for helping to connect us with Inga Thompson back in 2014.
Wait, I did that?
You did that by accident, actually. And I wanted to thank you again for helping her find her voice back in the spotlight to speak out on sporting issues.
Well, thank you.
But women's cycling has been a central point of our research and focus. We've done some advisory work in the space with a cyclist alliance, with Iris Loppendahl and her board. And I think actually that would be a great topic for one of your future podcasts, speak with her. But in the space, women's cycling has been traditionally overlooked and held down and diminished because it has not been seen in the traditional cycling space as a monetary driver. It's been always an add-on in the sense that there are some of the equity, or not equity, it's more of the parity in the Olympics between women's and men's events. But it's never really received the investment and focus. And yet now as we turn the corner, in 2019, into the part of the season, women's cycling is driving the highest uptake of content consumption in the sport.
Isn't that interesting?
Racing is consistent. Yes, it's consistently keeping pace or exceeding men's racing in terms of the viewership when it is available. And that is the criticality, when it is available. There are reforms taking place with the UCI, largely due to pressure from the women themselves, speaking out within the body of their nascent athletes association, the alliance, and also too from the fans themselves. Let's face it, the fans are demanding better racing and more racing, and what they're finding is that on the women's side, it's less formulaic and much more exciting than a men's race, which takes 4 hours to develop to have 1 hour of action. On the women's side, it is, to quote an old football term, every race is a slobber knocker. They are going at it, and they are smart, they are sharp, they are fit, they are articulate, and the best ambassadors that the sport has, and we're not utilizing them.
Wow. That's so cool that you would say that. Once again, I'm speaking with Steve Maxwell and Joe Harris. We're talking about how cycling needs some complete revamping at the end that would bring it into the view of all of the fans, of all of the fans. That's where, you know, I know lots of people who come to me and say, did you see this? Did you see that? And because of all these disparate places to go and look at things, I don't. You know, I get what I get, and by hook or by crook, because I'm not one of those people who, you know, ferrets out every single race, although, you know, I probably should be. But I do want to move on to some of the things, the eight lessons you got from other professional sports. And there's one that is particularly absent that I wondered if you had considered, and that's the way golf has grown. And you didn't include it, and I just wondered why, because it's kind of one of those you got to follow along sports. You're not sitting in a stadium for that either.
Yeah, that's a good point. We didn't really address the parallels or the lessons too much. You know, we did look at several lessons from other sports. One of which was the length and sort of duration of the calendar in this sport and how it runs for, you know, what seems like practically the whole year. That there might be some value of sort of a, you know, enhanced scarcity of events in the sport, or kind of focusing more effort on building a smaller number of bigger events that will be easier for fans to track. And so we have a number of ideas that, you know, will attract plenty of controversy, I'm sure, but a number of ideas about ways to revamp, shorten, and sort of change around the traditional schedule. We also looked at the various models of more of a franchise-based sports like we see amongst the key professional sports in the U.S., what kind of advantages or challenges would cycling face from more of a franchise model, you know, maybe like we have in baseball or football in this country, or maybe the sort of promotion and relegation types of options that we have between the different football divisions in the U.K. Premier football leagues. So we looked at other sports. We looked at the sport of tennis. We looked at the sport of F1, Formula One racing, and tried to draw a parallel where we could between things that have been successful in other sports, while keeping in mind the sort of unique nature of road cycling, if you will. Not all of these models really apply to cycling, but there may be bits and pieces here and there that we can take from other sports and learn from other sports. Joe talked a little bit about the entertainment and the television and ways of delivering the sport more broad, you know, to a broader audience. We talked about a lot of coverage and production techniques that could be utilized in cycling that are common in other sports that really haven't taken hold here yet. So I guess the summary there, Diane, would be that we think there are obviously, all these things we take with a grain of salt, and we understand that they will be controversial or provocative, but we think it's worthwhile to at least consider models of what has worked and what hasn't worked in other sports, and at least consider how they might be applied to cycling.
Since you wrote the first report, there are now five, I think, and what you're doing is taking each of those sort of conclusions you've come to or ideas you've come to and expanded on them. So the most recent one is attract new fans with personalities and broadcast technology. And I actually have often said that one of the issues about cycling was they missed the boat with Greg LeMond, ended up glomming on to Lance Armstrong, who turned out to be, you know, sort of like Lex Luthor at the end, as opposed to Batman being the right guy, which is Greg LeMond. I can't believe I came up with mm-hmm. those particular analogies. That's kind of weird for me. But at any rate, attracting new fans with personalities makes so much sense, because one of the things we're lacking in, I think, in the sport is a younger audience. Our audience keeps getting older mm-hmm. and older. The cyclist is getting older and older. We're not bringing young people in.
No, that's right.
So how do you see doing
that? Yeah. We're seeing just by one little anecdote there. You know, I'm involved with the Velo News publication, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think that the average age of the reader for Velo News these days is like 55 or 56 years old or something
right.
like that. So it kind of underlines the point you're making. You know, really, there's a lot of ideas in our report about how to make the sport friendlier and more accessible and more understandable to a broader range of people. To answer your first question, however, and then maybe let Joe address this, is this report is actually we're publishing it now in a series of installments, of which there will be 10. And I think, as you pointed out, we published installment number 5 yesterday. But the report as a whole, it's one single document, which will be released and available in full to the public by RAFA at the end of this installment series. So we're kind of doling this out one sort of chapter at a time, but the full report will be available in the middle of May on a link from RAFA with a rather exhaustive, almost sort of academic-like set of footnotes and citations and appendices and so forth and so on. So what we're doing now, Diana, just kind of summarizing certain parts of the report and putting it out there for broader consumption via the Vela News website.
What are you getting in terms of feedback? Are people responding? Are they actually giving ideas and or comments?
Yeah, I'll quickly address that too. They are. We asked specifically for people to, you know, email us with ideas. We decided not to open up a comment section on the website just to try to maintain a little bit stricter quality control, if you will, on the feedback. But we've been getting quite a number of, I would say, pretty thoughtful, you know, oftentimes, you know, controversial, but pretty thoughtful ideas about particularly things like the schedule. I mean, this is something that really gets people's attention and gets people's sort of motor running, is, you know, suggesting that you might cut one of the grand tours, or that the Tour de France should be moved to August, or that the Giro should be 2 weeks instead of 3 weeks long. Those are the sorts of things that really fire people up. And so we have been getting a lot of feedback, and our intention is to sort of summarize and publicize and put together a couple of pieces towards the end of this process to summarize some of the other ideas and productive feedback that we are getting.
And so who wants to kind of wrap this up? We need to wrap it up. Unfortunately, it's a really fascinating topic, and I think I'm going to reserve the right to come back to it as you finish publishing all 10 segments of it, and then where we go from there. But tell me what you maybe are thinking in terms of long term. Do you have any ideas yet about who you can approach with some of this stuff and maybe get some real changes underway?
I can, Steve, if I can start, I'll just briefly summarize. You know, when we started this project, when RAFA approached us, this wasn't necessarily a RAFA-focused brand transformation. Really what it comes down to is that brands who are anchored to cycling, it is their market, are finding that the market is constricting because the sport can't expand the way it's constructed and the context in which it's delivered. And what we did is took a very broad approach to analyzing all of those factors that we have been independently looking at in our work on the Outer Line website, and going far more in depth. And I think that'll be apparent once the final report is completely, you know, laid out and published and available for download. But this is about the whole sport. This is about our love of the sport and what we think it can do based on our experiences in the broader business sphere. These are things we can start doing today. And when we looked at, you know, the way that it's structured in that very first installment, The Road Less Traveled, it's not that cycling hasn't tried some of these things before. It has not tried all of these things in a cohesive forward motion to be able to change its economic governance and basically its total prospects as a global sport. And that is really what I hope people take away from it. We have had a lot of people come to us asking what's next, sharing with us their vision as this has been rolling out in the feedback. And we're finding that it's not necessarily approaching other people. It is getting it in front of the right people and continuing those conversations.
So here's one that I didn't throw in there, and I'm only going to throw it in there for a second because we do need to wrap it up. But anybody talk about track?
Mm-hmm.
because track to me is a spectator sport. It's one of, I know there are not many tracks in the U.S. right now, although there are more than there were 10 years ago, but track racing to me seems to be one of those, just, it would capture the imagination. It's so fast and it's so fun. And when people crash, it's so cool, right? That's what people want to see, unfortunately.
We do cover it later in the report in depth, and of course it'll be in the report. But absolutely, track is an integral component of getting young people their first experience with bicycle racing. And of course, some of the best bicycle racers on the planet started out on track, and we should not overlook that.
So let's tell our listeners how they can both read the RAFA roadmap report and how to find you at the Outer Line. What are those? I mean, how are you directing people?
The report is being published on Velo News on our Outer Line segment on the Velo News webpage on Tuesdays and Thursdays, starting 2 weeks ago and running for a couple more weeks. As I mentioned earlier, there will be 10 installments that summarize most of the report. At the time that the last installment is published, the entire report, as I mentioned, with all the backup materials and appendices and so forth, will actually be made available to anybody in the public via a PDF on a link from RAPA. So the whole thing will be available at that point, and we'll publish still 4 or 5 more installments. Our website, where we do our writing and publishing, most of which we do in conjunction with Velo News, is at www.theouterline.com. That's where Joe and I and one of our other colleagues publish the materials that we kind of write on an ongoing basis.
Well, you guys are doing some really interesting and I think important work underlying our sport. You know, some people don't delve into the things that will make it successful in a way that I think you guys are, and I really appreciate, especially that it's a labor of love. It's not like you're making $1 million doing this stuff. We all know that Outer Line, especially, you guys have like day jobs, as they say. So you are doing some great work. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Steve Maxwell and Joe Harris from the RAFA Roadmap Report and the Outer Line website. We will talk to you again once the report is all out there and wrapped up. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Diane.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Joe Harris and Steve Maxwell join me to talk about the RAFA Roadmap Report. As of today, 8 of the 10 segments of the report have been published. If you're interested in reading any or all of it, you can log on to velonews.com and search for the RAFA Roadmap Report. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll chat with Denise Korenik about her ride to a world record on two wheels. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
When Denise Korenik sets her mind to something, clearly nothing holds her back. Last fall, she and race car driver Shay Holbrook set out to break the land-paced world speed record on two wheels, and break it they did. Hi, Denise. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me again, and congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much.
So last time we spoke, I can't believe it was 2017. You broke the record for the fastest woman on two wheels, 147.72 miles per hour. And I vividly remember your description of what it took and how terrified I would have been. But you also told me then that you wanted to be the fastest person on two wheels and wanted to break the overall record. And last September, you did it. You really did it.
Yes, it was definitely a long journey because from conception of even doing the first ever women's record started in 2012. And then in 2016, that became a reality. So there's a 4-year long journey, but we weren't quite happy we were very happy with the results, but weren't happy because we knew we could do more and we were rained out the very last day of the event. And we just looked at each other. We didn't even confer with each other. We just said, screw it. We're coming back next year. And we're going to take the overall record. And it took us, unfortunately, 2 years to be able to come back. And we accomplished our goal, which is very unique for a lot of people out at Bonneville Salt Flats that are into the cars and motorcycles, because a lot of times it's multiple year attempts to be able to do something. And we are so very amazingly fortunate to have, first time we went out there in 2016, we accomplished that goal, and we came back in 2018 and we accomplished that goal. So very blessed.
What did you do differently the second time to get that speed up? And we're not going to tell them yet what the speed was. I know what it is. Okay. You know what it is, but yeah. I want to sort of like build up to that.
Okay. Well, few things are different. We wanted to utilize the same vehicle used in 2016, which is a Range Rover Sport SVR. And it was that max speed on that vehicle was 175 miles an hour. So it was quite capable to do the 147, which is what we did in 2016. So we wanted to be able to use that one again, because at that top speed, it would have been enough to break the existing men's record. And so it was unfortunate we didn't talk to our sponsors when we said we'd come back out. And it was very difficult, and we were unable to utilize the vehicle. And so we ended up now on a search in order to find another vehicle that not only was capable of doing the speeds we need, but was also able to be outfitted with all the safety standards required and put a fairing on it. And that's a pretty tall order. We tried to go with OEM. Vehicle manufacturers, and we really just didn't get anybody to bite. And so we ended up going back to Fred Rumpelberg, who is the current men's record holder from 1995. And we knew that he had his vehicle stored away in Utah with the Strasburg Racing family. And we asked to be able to utilize that, which was a huge undertaking. He did allow us to use the vehicle, but it required months of everything being overhauled because it sat for 23 years. But that is what we did. We had to use that vehicle. So that was different. Our bicycle was the exact same bicycle. We just, of course, overhauled everything on the bicycle. I did get a new suit because we had some different sponsors. And so Primal came back on board again and helped with creating the suit that we had. And I guess, and then also, you know, KHS, they had been behind us literally from the inception of the idea in sponsoring the bike build and what have you. So I mean, we had some sponsors that stayed on and helped us make this happen, but the biggest difference was that vehicle. And then obviously a higher speed that now we had to break a record. Whereas in 2016, we came out to set a women's record. There was no bar that we had to break. 2018, we had a number we had to break.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Denise Karenik. She is a very special record holder. We talked with her back in 2017 when she broke the women's fastest land speed record at 147.72. And we have a brand new record, and she smashed the men's record too. And we'll go with that for right now. So did you change your training any to ramp up to this new goal?
I tweaked it a little because now I had a very good idea of what was needed. Whereas we came into 2016, you know, I had the experience from my coach, John Howard, who had done the record back in 85, but it had been a number of years. And so he built up the training that was necessary, and I was able to accomplish 2016. But now that we knew what was necessary, we were able to tighten that up. There was a lot of oscillations backwards and forwards, so little mini, almost intervals that were occurring. So we created a little bit of a different setup for my motor pacing. And so we were training down at the velodrome in San Diego behind a motorcycle, and that was a little bit different than the road motor pacing training that we were doing in 2016. So it was a little bit more precise to what my actual physical output with my muscles would end up being.
Is that a banked track or is that a flat track?
It is a banked track.
That's scary.
Not a very steep track, but yeah, it's a great learner track for a lot of people who are getting velodrome racing and what have you, because it's a very forgiving track because it's not as steep as some of the indoor tracks. Yeah. So, and then we did this thing called maximum overload. Jacques DeVore is a trainer, a strength and conditioning trainer up in LA area. And we talked with him, and he helped us in developing a very specific maximum overload for cyclists type of training with deadlifts. I was doing 230 pounds in deadlifts. I was doing walking lunges, holding 35 pounds in each hand and doing them for minutes at a time. So a lot of very, very specialized workouts. So we were able to tweak based on that. So the training was essentially the same, but a little more tweaked and specialized for my needs.
Well, on your first go around, you chose a woman to drive your lead vehicle at that special constant speed. Second time, the two of you teamed up again. Tell us about Shay and her role and the role she plays, because it's a really important one in your attempt.
Oh, absolutely. Shay Holbrook, our race car driver and the pace car driver for both 2016 and 2018, is an absolutely essential part of this. She is the one who we had to figure out. We were like dancing partners, if I, you know, say that. Whereas I'm getting the recognition because I did the record, I was on the bicycle, but she held my life in her hands, because if she did something that could cause me to go down, that could be almost the end of me. And so where she's fully protected, seatbelted in, roll cage around her, she's in a very safe position. There's very few things that could occur that would put her life in danger out there, because we're going in an absolute straight line. But her and I built upon what we did in 2016, and it was essential that we were the same team coming back in 2018, because we were two dance partners that had to figure out not how to not step on each other's feet, so to say, because we had a lot of aborted runs in 2016 where I came out the back of the draft because she was putting too much into the accelerator and I didn't have quite enough of a bubble of air that was able to hold me in there, and it was too difficult and I'd pop out of the back. We had that moment where we finally sat down and we went, okay, what's going on? We reviewed the video. We talked about this, what I'm experiencing. And she shared with what she was. And we discovered that we were just out of sync. And so we went out there on the last day we ended up having runs. And we did one run at 140 miles an hour. It was like simple. And we went, oh my gosh, we finally figured this magic out, the dance, we call it. So we were in sync with each other. We went back out there and we actually debated. We said, should we wait till tomorrow? Because I know we got it. We did the one good run. We're in sync. And we went, you know what? Let's just go one more run out there, get another good solid run. And then tomorrow we're really going to go for the record. Well, we went out there. We did the 147.7 without really trying. I mean, it was more of a just want to get a good one. But we had really gotten in sync with each other and went, okay, we are so ready. Little did we know the rain was going to happen and we weren't able to do any more runs. And that became the record. So for that, we came into 2018 and we had issues with the vehicle that we brought out in 2018, Fred Rompelberg's vehicle. And we were not able to do any practice runs until the actual event occurred. The event started, and the very first run she did was without me behind her so that she could get her bearings in this new vehicle. And then the second run we did, and then the speedometer broke. So she had no idea how fast she was going. So she went really a lot slower than normal, and I released and I was working my tail off because we were under 110 miles an hour, which is really the ideal point for me to be able to start pushing the gear. So we then had only two more runs in that vehicle, but we pushed it. But we knew and we built upon those 17 runs total that we did in training and the event in 2016. And it was like we just changed one piece of equipment, the vehicle, and it was still her and I in sync with each other. And if we did not have that, if I had a brand new driver in 2018, I could almost guarantee you this record would not have occurred.
So let's tell people how fast you did go. But before that, what was the previous record?
The previous record for the, as they call it, the paced bicycle land speed record was by Fred Rompelberg in 1995 at 166.9 miles per hour.
And what did Denise and Shay do?
And I came out there and we sort of had a goal of 170 just to be able to get into the next category. Little did we know we were going to blow right through the 170s. And we ended up with 183.9 miles per hour. So basically 17 miles an hour, we beat the men's record.
Wow. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Denise Korenik, who is the, I guess, fastest person on two wheels in the world. Wow, 183. That's amazing. It's amazing.
Yes. And as fastest person on a bicycle, because there are motorcyclists that are out there faster, but yes.
Yes, bicycle, two-wheel bicycle. Sorry, that I should have, even though, of course, this is a bicycle show, right? So we do know. So what's changed for you personally since this record?
You know, not much. I'm still the same person that I was. I mean, you know, one thing that really did occur was there's a huge outpouring of coverage that we thought, okay, we're going to get the coverage like what we got press-wise in 2016. But man, in 2018, I guess a woman breeding a men's record and the speed being such phenomenally faster at 183.9 miles an hour, it just sort of took on a whole new, it was on a big old wave of publicity. So there's a lot of people that I now see and they mention, oh, I've seen that, or I've watched that video, or I heard that on the news. And so it's sort of interesting. It's sort of a subculture notoriety, as my coach called it, for when he had his record, is you met people and they knew about it. So that's really cool. But one of the things I really want to be able to do with that is to take it to the next level and inspire other people. I was inspired by three ladies in the gym that decided to run their very first marathon back in 2009. And we watched them train for this. And a group of us went down and cheered them on. And I remember going, man, that's cool. I'm going to do that next year. So I set my first big goal back in 2009 to run a marathon in 2010. Little did I know that then that goal set another goal, and led me back to meet up with my coach, who got me back on my bicycle, who suggested this record. And you keep on going. I can literally tie it all the way to those three ladies, which I have thanked since then, for their inspiration. And they had no idea. But the thing is, you just never know when you're going to be able to inspire somebody. And that's what I'd love to be able to do. And so I want to go out and do inspirational speaking, and especially to the corporate world, because I was 23 years, raised the family, ran a business, and, sort of came back into this and was able to do this in my second athletic, I guess, life, you could say, after all of that. And a lot of people give up and don't do anything. And I'd love to be able to, just inspire one person out there to get out there and get back into the game of life.
Well, that's true. We didn't mention it in this particular conversation, but originally we talked about the fact that you were a bike racer as a younger woman.
Yes.
And now, you came back to it later. So has anybody come to you saying, I want to beat your record yet?
Yes, there are actually two gentlemen that are planning on besting this record. And the first one's from Belgium. And Luke Vaughn something or other, I don't have the name right off the tip of my tongue, but he's from Belgium and he is doing a lot of training. I guess he's building his bicycle now. We don't know what vehicle he's going to use. It appears it may be that he's going to attempt to use Fred Rompelberg's vehicle also, but we just don't know. But he has put it out there that he is going for at minimum 300 kilometers per hour, because if you do the math, my 183.9 miles per hour ends up being around 296 point something kilometers per hour. So the next little marker there for people is 300 kilometers an hour. And so that gentleman's going for it. There's also a gentleman by the name of Neil. He's an architect out in the UK, and he's actually already gone 149 miles per hour on a short 2 mile runway out in the UK. He has posted something about 220 in 2020. So I really don't know where his, how he's going to put everything together, because doing it on a 2 mile stretch of road.
No, it's too short.
Yeah, it is. And then what it would do is leave the question of, well, how long were you actually attached and what did you get pulled to? Because one of the things for me is I released at mile marker 1 1/4. And I had to go 3 3/4 miles under my own power for that very last mile to be the measured record. And so it's important because there is no governing body for this. And so technically someone could basically be towed right up to the moment of the record starting and they release and then basically float through. And I don't think that would be very fair. So the place to really have this done is the Bonneville Salt Flats. And that is where the gentleman from Belgium plans to do it. I don't think the gentleman from the UK can do it in a 2 mile runway. It's just going to be very, very difficult to reach the speed without it being basically pulled all the way up to the number.
So do you have any new goals? Like you need
yes.
one, right? Okay,
yeah.
Let's hear it.
Well, I was actually done, and here's the little bit backstory.
Done. Have you figured it out yet?
That's true. I it's like somebody saying, boy, I have a busy day, and you sit there and go, yeah, every day is going to be busy no matter what I'm doing. So I had sort of hung the bike up because, again, this is an intense 6-year journey. And 20 hours a week of working out and driving to and from workouts, it took a lot of balancing with life. And I was a little done with, you know, that aspect of it. So I sort of hung the bike up and said, oh, I'm going to get back into doing half marathons for fun. And believe me, I'm a mid-packer when it comes to half marathons, but it's for fun and knocking out all the states. And so I had taken 5 months basically off the bike. I'd only been on the bike 5 times in that 5 months and started sort of running a little. And so I went from 20 hours a week of working out to about 3 hours a week of working out. And I get a call from a gentleman named Larry Lem, who's part of the Human Powered Vehicle Association, which is also bicycles. And he has been involved for 19 years with them, and he actually has a bicycle with a pod that he feels can beat the women's record, but he just needed to have a female cyclist. And he reached out to me and said, hey, I'd like you to be able to take my vehicle and be able to go for the women's record, which is 75.69 miles an hour without any draft. So I'll be able to answer the question, which a lot of people would ask me, is if you didn't have that car in front of you, setting the speed and creating that wind pocket that you were surfing in, how fast could you go? And I really, you know, it's a hard question to answer. And I guess this September, I'm going to have the answer for that, because we'll know exactly how fast I'm able to go without having a vehicle in front of me.
Where will we be able to see that?
Well, I think at this point it will be on Facebook. We'll probably do a lot of live Facebook lives and things of that nature, because I don't think it's publicized television wise. These are some very obscure different records, but this is an established record that's been around. I will not be the first woman to do it, but afterwards to be able to say, I own the motor-paced fastest woman in the world and for fastest cyclist in the world, and to beat the unpaced and to have the unpaced record. That would be so cool to be able to have those two speed records.
That would. Well, Denise, it was just so cool to see you do that. And how can people see your 2018 record, the 183.9?
The best place is to go to YouTube, and you can search Project Speed Denise and make sure to look for the one that says 183.9 or Project Speed Wrap-Up. Those will be two of our videos, but an excellent sort of 20-minute, almost documentary, where you get to really meet Shay and you get to meet my coach, and there's a lot more explanation, is from Wall Street Journal. And if you go to the Wall Street Journal website, WSJ.com, you do not need to be a subscriber, and you put Denise Karenik bicycle or just Denise and bicycle, and that video will come up in the search on their website and take 20 minutes. It's a good 20-minute long little documentary, and that's a perfect one to be able to check it out.
Well, we will check back with you after your next attempt at the unpaced record and see what happens. So this is a fared vehicle. So it's sort of like a recumbent. You're down low, right?
Yes, and it is a recumbent, and it's a monocoque type design of fiberglass with a porthole that I sort of get stuffed into, and it gets closed on top of me. And
right.
I literally have no visual of what's in front of me. I'm actually looking at a video screen in front of my handlebars.
Well, you're a little astronaut on the ground. There you go.
Yep.
Well, Denise, thank you so much for telling us about this record. It's wonderful that, number one, a woman set the record, the world record, and that you're still out there doing stuff. I appreciate you talking with me.
All right.
Take care. Denise Karenik joined me from her home in California. If you are interested in seeing the video documentary, you can log on to YouTube and search for Denise and Speed Record. You'll actually be able to see a lot of different options in addition to the 20-minute documentary. So my thanks to Joe Harris and Steve Maxwell, as well as Denise Karenik, for joining me on the show this week. Remember that the broadcast version of The Outspoken Cyclist will move to its new time, 7:30 a.m. on WJCU 88.7 FM next Saturday, May 18th. As always, you can join the conversation on our Facebook page or leave us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E. You can also comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. Join me next week when we explore the Fanny Ride in New York State and speak with retired Olympian and contributor to the TrainRight.com blog, Mara Abbott. We'll also have part two of our series on treating sports injuries with orthopedic sports specialist, Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.